Dr. Collins was at the forefront of the design and implementation of the Human Genome Project and was responsible for seeing it to its completion. He is known for his close attention to ethical and legal issues in genetics. He is a strong advocate for protecting the privacy of genetic information and has served as the national leader in efforts to prohibit gene-based insurance discrimination. Building on his own experiences as a young physician volunteer in a rural missionary hospital in Nigeria, Dr. Collins is also very interested in opening avenues for genome research to benefit the health of people living in developing and poor countries. And he shares this interest, of course, with our second speaker, Dr. Francis Collins.
Well, thank you very much, Vice Chancellor Price, and good afternoon to all of you. It's a real pleasure and a privilege to be here in Cape Town to speak in this special pair of lectures. And again, it's a special pleasure to share the podium with my friend, Sir Mark Walport. And I've had a wonderful day because Greg Hussey and others have hosted me, and Roger Glass, who was introduced a moment ago, who's the head of the Fogarty International Center at NIH, and allowed us to spend time with a variety of investigators who are studying aspects of both infectious and non-communicable diseases here in Cape Town. We've been to visit the Institute of Infectious Diseases and Molecular Medicine. We took a field site visit to the Khayelitsha Clinic. I hope I've said that somewhere close to recognizably. We stopped on the way back from that clinic and visited a secondary hospital, and then we visited with the Red Cross War Memorial Children's Hospital, a really remarkable facility for pediatrics. And then we spent a couple of hours this afternoon at the Center of Excellence on Non-Communicable Chronic Diseases, hosted by Dinky Levitt. So we've had quite a wonderful day, and I must say I'm very impressed and inspired by the work going on here. This is my first visit to Cape Town, actually my first visit to South Africa, although I've been to Africa on a half dozen occasions. It's the first time I've been able to be here in this beautiful city. And in preparing for this visit and thinking about other Americans who had come to this town, it occurred to me that one of them gave one of the best speeches that has ever, I think, been given by anybody on any topic, and so I decided that I would quote a few sentences from it because they resonate with my own experience coming here today. This is a speech not from last week, but this is a speech from 45 years ago. In a few hours, the speaker said, I'll tell you who it is shortly, but you may recognize the speech. The plane that brought me to this country crossed over oceans and countries which have been a crucible of human history. In minutes, we traced migrations of men over thousands of years. We could see no national boundaries, no vast gulfs or high walls dividing people from people, only nature and the works of man, homes and factories and farms, everywhere reflecting man's common effort to enrich his life. Everywhere, new technology and communications brings men and nations closer together. The concerns of one inevitably becomes the concerns of all. And our new closeness is stripping away the false masks, the illusion of differences, which is the root of injustice and of hate and of war. The words of Robert F. Kennedy, spoken here in Cape Town, June 6, 1966, in his speech, A Tiny Ripple of Hope. And those words, again, reflecting the shared humanity that we all have as our common ancestry, certainly fit nicely with this occasion, because it is by the study of the genome, more than perhaps anything else we've done in science, that we have learned to see with ever greater clarity that we all are part of one family, and that we are all Africans, and that we all started here, and that our future is knitted together just as our past has been. And so I thought that would be an appropriate way to begin to think about this topic today of genomics and global health in 2011. It was already mentioned that I have had my own experiences in Africa as a volunteer in a missionary hospital. And here is a photograph from a while back. This is in the Delta area of Nigeria, working in that instance with a Nigerian resident The procedure that we are carrying out there is a pericardiocentesis on an individual who had a tuberculous pericardial effusion and cardiac tamponade, which was very threatening imminently to his survival. That experience in Nigeria was transformative to me because it caused me both to get a better sense of what the needs are in the world, but also to appreciate the courage and the remarkable abilities of people in sub-Saharan Africa if resources are available to do great things. And I believe in that absolutely based on that experience, and everything that I've had the chance to be part of since only further reinforces it. The other thing I learned in that trip, and I was there for a couple of tours, was that while infectious diseases were, in fact, the main reason that people came to our clinics and to our hospital, it was also clear there were non-communicable diseases causing a fair amount of morbidity and mortality as well. And one of them was diabetes. And for me as an internist, for whom diabetes was a familiar disease, but one that I did not really expect to see in West Africa, I was intrigued by that. And over the course of quite a few years after that, talking with other people who also could see there was a real research opportunity here, and particularly with Charles Rotimi, who is now here in this audience as the leader of much of the thinking about H3 Africa, a project was born called ADAM, the Africa-America Diabetes Mellitus Study, which aimed to collect DNA samples and much other information about individuals with diabetes or normal controls in Ghana and in Nigeria. And that project, which continues to this day, has become a very interesting window into genetic and environmental risk factors for diabetes in those two countries. And certainly one can trace a line, although it's probably a dotted line, between that experience and what we are here to begin tomorrow, this discussion about mounting a much larger, more ambitious project in sub-Saharan Africa to try to identify genetic and environmental risk factors for common diseases. So H3 Africa, which is a joint endeavor of the Wellcome Trust and of the NIH, and we hope many other partners as well, is an effort to try to do just that, to take advantage of new technologies that allow us to survey the genome in ever more precise ways, and to also build upon the capacity for research, which is growing in Africa and which we believe could be grown even further with projects of this sort, by empowering African investigators to take the lead in this enterprise and to see what we could do together. The picture you see there is from June of last year when we announced this partnership between NIH and the Wellcome Trust. And all five of the people in that picture are actually a part of the meeting that is going on tomorrow. And I believe at least four of them are here in the audience, although I think Eric Green in the center may not be. But you will recognize Sir Mark Walport, myself, Charles Rotimi over there on the far right, and on the left, Dr. Bongani Mayosi, the chairman of medicine here at University of Cape Town. And together, we have put together a general plan, a white paper, which outlines a very ambitious but very exciting project to undertake in the coming years, to which the NIH has made a commitment of $5 million a year over the course of 5 years. And the Wellcome Trust has similarly made a very generous commitment in order to have this go forward as ambitiously as possible. Let me say a word about why this fits, then, with the NIH agenda. As now the director of the National Institutes of Health, I am charged with overseeing biomedical research and how we invest our U.S. taxpayer dollars in that. And the NIH mission is a twofold mission that includes both science in pursuit of fundamental knowledge, that's our basic science component, but also the application of that knowledge to extend healthy life and reduce the burdens of illness and disability. When I came to this job, now just about a year and 8 months ago, I thought a lot about what, in fact, might be themes that would help focus NIH's effort at this unique time when so many scientific opportunities are emerging. And out of that deliberation, after talking to lots of people, came five themes. One was to apply high-throughput technologies to understand fundamental biology and uncover the causes of specific diseases. And here I'm talking about genomics, to be sure. but also other aspects of high-throughput analysis, chemical genomics, the effort to be able to do computational biology on large data sets, imaging approaches, nanotechnology, all of these things which have come along fairly recently and provide the opportunity to ask comprehensive questions that have the word all in them. What are all the variations in the genome that contribute to a particular disease? What are all the proteins in the cell? What are all the components of the immune system? Questions like that we would not have been bold enough to ask even a few years ago, but now have the potential of not only asking but answering because these technologies are making that possible. A second theme, one which is critically necessary if we are serious about having research advances reach out and change things for those individuals who are at risk for disease or already afflicted by disease, is to translate these basic science discoveries into new and better treatments. And this is a major area of focus right now at NIH. In fact, we will be by next October starting a new center for advancing translational sciences in order to try to catalyze these developments. The third area, and particularly important one for us now in the U.S., is to be sure that as NIH, we're providing as much in the way of evidence as we can to undergird the way in which our healthcare system is being revamped as part of healthcare reform. And that means doing a lot of research efforts that fit into things like comparative effectiveness research, where you're trying to really figure out amongst alternatives to intervene in a particular medical condition what actually works, and not just hope that you know the answer. But the fourth theme, encouraging a greater focus on global health, is obviously relevant to today's discussion and is the one that frankly surprised most people who saw this list emerge because they didn't quite expect that to be on the list for the United States National Institutes of Health. The fifth one, reinvigorating and empowering the biomedical research community, is about our most critical resource, which is in fact the scientific community. The energies, the creativity, the innovative potential of scientists across the board from basic to clinical, who we really depend upon to come up with the new ideas, and we need to be sure that they are given that kind of encouragement. But it is this fourth one, encouraging a greater focus on global health, which we are particularly, I think, interested in discussing during the course of this symposium. And this is focused on infectious diseases, to be sure, but also on non-communicable disorders like depression, as in this example. So why, people might ask, and some did, why is global health research, well, okay, it's important, some said. Why is it actually one of those things that rises to find its place on this short list of five themes? Well, there are plenty of good answers for that. Scientific advances make an attack on infectious diseases more feasible than ever. The ability to use things like RNAi or small molecule screening, the ability to determine the complete genomes of pathogens and vectors and the host, humans, gives us a window into new drug development or vaccine development that we wouldn't have had before. And the opportunity, therefore, to go beyond AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis and to focus some more energies on neglected tropical diseases like schistosomiasis, for instance, for which we have a significant program underway at NIH that has led to the development of the first new promising therapeutic compound in 50 years. And, of course, a disease that affects 250 million people but has received relatively little attention in the research community in the U.S. in the past because it doesn't affect very many people, if at all, in our country. But here is a scientific opportunity to do something about that. And there is this need also to recognize that the non-communicable diseases are the most rapidly growing area of morbidity and mortality and also are very much in need of attention and certainly are shared issues across the world, both in low, middle, and high-income countries. But I must say another very good reason is that around me in the U.S., when I talk to young medical researchers, the thing that I often hear from them is their passion about global health, their sense that this is the time to put some of their energies into an area because they perceive both the opportunity and the responsibility. And NIH has been doing this, and Roger Glass, as the head of the Fogarty International Center, could give you many examples how over the course of years we have been investing in countries across the world. This map shows you everything that's in green are countries that, in fact, have received NIH dollars and are receiving them, and you will certainly see African countries represented, while not universally, quite in significant numbers.
And South Africa, I might say, is the African country that receives the largest proportion of NIH funding, with about $60 million this year of research funding coming here, and much of it, I might point out, especially after seeing the evidence today, comes here to Cape Town. This is this diagram, just to make this point about non-communicable diseases, that I think surprises a lot of people who are so used to the idea that global health equates to infectious disease, that that's really not the way things are going. And if you look at the predictions here over the course of 2004 to 2030, look at the low-income category, where, again, I think many people would have assumed that the areas of greatest mortality would be these bottom conditions here, HIV, AIDS, TB, malaria, and other infectious diseases. Well, look, those are expected, actually, to diminish because of very important efforts that are going on to exercise better prevention and treatment. So what ends up becoming the dominant cause of mortality in 2030 in low-income countries? Well, it's maternal perinatal nutritional conditions, it's cardiovascular diseases, cancers, other non-communicable diseases. And clearly that is a circumstance that demands a response. And so increasingly in conversations about global health, including today, non-communicable diseases need the attention that they're starting to get. Nature writes features about this, which is a good thing. The NIH is very committed as a partner to the Global Alliance for Chronic Diseases, which aims to try to bring together countries that are interested in this area and figure out ways to fund research projects together. We had a recent meeting in China focused on research projects focused on hypertension, which is obviously a major cause of mortality and morbidity in the form of cardiovascular diseases and stroke, including here in Africa. And there is this upcoming September UN Non-Communicable Disease Summit, which I think many of us are excited about as another opportunity to pull together many countries' interests and try to identify resources in order to push forward the agenda, including research for non-communicable diseases. But now let me turn to the Human Genome Project and how it fits with all this, because my charge here was to speak to you about genomics and how it plays a role in global health. And certainly genomics is something that I have a great deal of affection for, having spent some 17 years as the director of the National Human Genome Research Institute before becoming director of NIH. And let me say, the Human Genome Project, I think, will stand as one of humankind's most ambitious enterprises. But it will also stand as a very fine example of an international effort, as Max Price said in the introduction, involving scientists actually in 6 countries from 20 laboratories, and with major support coming from our fine colleagues at the Wellcome Trust, the NIH, and others. But it was my job to serve as the field marshal of this enterprise, trying to organize what seemed to be initially an impossible effort to read out those 3 billion letters of the Human DNA Instruction Book. But happily, because of the very intense and creative efforts of thousands of scientists who saw this as a historic opportunity they wanted to be part of, and who decided early on that giving all the data away every 24 hours was the right thing to do so that every scientist who had an idea about how to use it could get started right away, the Human Genome Project succeeded in that effort and produced a map and a sequence of human DNA, initially as a draft, then ultimately as a finished sequence, and now allows us to really begin to try to understand how to read this book. And it is a challenge because, of course, it's written in this funny language with 4 letters in its alphabet, but it's not a language that one can just look at and interpret. So a great deal of work now underway, and very exciting work, to understand the functions of the human genome. This has utterly transformed the way we do research. Graduate students today in human genetics can't imagine how anybody did this kind of research at all until you had the ability to just look up the sequence on the internet. In terms of its effects on clinical medicine, I think those are still modest, but they're coming. And they're coming in interesting ways for both rare and common diseases. They're coming for cancer, which I think Sir Mark may speak a little bit about. I want to say something, though, about what you want to know about the genome. Besides this initial sequence, which in the case of the public project came from a series of 5 or 6 anonymous individuals, and had no intention in that first pass to try to understand anything about phenotypic consequences or even to try to catalog variation in a systematic way. But as soon as we had that reference sequence, if you want to call it that, the next thing you want to have is the variations. You want to know, okay, we're not all the same. There's differences in our genome sequences, and some of those probably matter for medical reasons. Don't you want that catalog too? And that led then almost immediately, in fact, before the genome sequence was quite done, to the formation of yet another international genome effort, the HapMap project, another project I had the privilege of leading and which involved six countries, not quite the same six, and a lot of support, again, from multiple sources, again, involving the Wellcome Trust with NIH, very invested in trying to do this. But here, of course, if you want to look at variation, you'll have to think carefully in this initial pass where we could only afford to look at maybe about 300 samples. Where should those samples come from? The debates about that were intense. The decision was that those samples ought to have variation of some sort around the world, and I'll tell you in a moment what that looked like. But this did produce genotypes for 3.5 million variants, single nucleotide polymorphisms, SNPs, in 270 samples, giving you something about how common those variants were, the allele frequencies, something about haplotypes, that is, were adjacent variants traveling together or not. And this was then very useful as a means of setting up the opportunity to begin to scan the whole genome, looking for variants that were associated with disease risk, what we now call a genome-wide association study. And it also spurred a whole industry of developing highly informative, inexpensive methods of scanning up to 1 million of these SNPs in one experiment in order to be able to, say, look at 2,000 people with diabetes and 2,000 people who didn't and begin to see what the differences were. Now, where did the samples come from? Well, here's an example of somebody who's involved, who is actually carrying in his hand there the consent form for the HapMap project. This is a chief in Nigeria, because, in fact, we thought long and hard about how to do this and felt that it was important to get samples from Africa as well as Asia, as well as individuals whose origins were from Europe. And we also felt it was important to do this in a fashion that engaged communities so that people had a sense of how these samples would be collected and described. Community advisory groups were involved in this. Charles Rodemy, again, was very much instrumental in setting up how to do this. And in this case, this community advisory group in Ibadan representing the Yoruba was a good example of a new kind of interaction between research and communities. The consent was both individual as well as this community consultation process. HapMap did not intend to try to connect variations with phenotypes, but simply to have anonymous samples where variation could be described, recognizing that the connection to phenotypes would be a later step, which I'll come to in a moment. But just the same, it seemed important that benefits to the participants ought to be provided. And so, in fact, that was the case, and this will certainly be something we will be talking about with the H3 Africa study. So the HapMap samples, 270 of them, you can see, were divided in this fashion, with 90 from the Yoruba, 90 from individuals in Utah with European ancestry, 45 Japanese from Tokyo, 45 Han Chinese from Beijing. Not to say that anybody should think of these samples as being more than just that. Certainly you would not want to say Africa is well represented by 90 Yoruba from Nigeria. But as a start, this was actually a pretty useful database. It has gone on to become now a much more intense effort to survey variation in the genome by the founding and conduct of the 1,000 Genomes Project. And the 1,000 genomes actually has become 2,500 over the course of recognizing that more is better. And again, in this instance, this includes a search not only for single nucleotide polymorphisms, but for other kinds of variants that are more complicated, insertions, deletions, copy number variants, structural variants, and so on. And because so many samples are being sequenced, this should be a pretty comprehensive view of any variations in the human population that are present at a frequency of 1% or greater. And that means that if you're looking for a variant of that frequency that's associated with a common disease, it should be in the database. It's just up to you to apply this database to disease cohorts in order to find the ones that are going to be conveying that kind of risk. So these 2,500 samples have no identifying or medical data. The samples you can see listed here are from various parts of Africa. African Americans are included, Mexican American, Puerto Rican, Colombian, Peruvian, several different groups in Asia, as well as in South India. So this is, while again, nothing like what one would call a comprehensive sample of the human population, it is certainly more broad in its reach than HapMap was. And all of these samples, again, being collected with care as far as the consent process and the community consultation. So the first view of this, published last October in terms of a pilot and preparing for phase one data release coming up on 1,004 samples. This will certainly be yet another of those sort of landmark efforts in understanding the human genome, along with the original sequence, along with the HapMap, and now the 1,000 genomes. But again, these provide you with a foundation of information. They don't tell you within themselves anything about actual phenotypic consequences. For that purpose, investigators have been using this data to try to identify variants that do predict risk for common diseases like diabetes and hypertension, like the common cancers, or asthma, or multiple sclerosis, or Crohn's disease. And the progress here has been breathtaking in terms of the numbers of discoveries. This is a cartoon showing you the human chromosomes 1 through 22 and the X and the Y. And each one of those colored circles represents a well-validated genetic variant that's associated with risk for a common disease. Each of the colors is a different disease. It would be difficult at this point to think of a common disease that's not represented here because this has been applied so strongly over the course of the last 4 or 5 years, which has become possible because of HapMap and now because of 1,000 genomes. Now, each of these variants is here, for the most part, contributes rather modestly to disease risk, and so this has not turned out to be incredibly valuable as far as personalized preventive medicine to predict individuals' future risk for disease, although there is useful information here. But what this has done is to point towards pathways that are involved in diseases that we didn't know about before and that create new ideas about therapeutics that are actually quite exciting in many instances. So this is sort of the first wave of the harvesting of what we can learn using this foundational information about human variation to discover what are the molecular contributors to common diseases, the things that in general have been so vexing for us to understand. My own lab works on type 2 diabetes, adult onset diabetes. And we are now up to almost 60 variants that have been discovered that play a role in risks for that. And they make some sense in terms of pointing to certain pathways, but those were not pathways that we knew about for the most part. It also turns out that of those 60, we've discovered most of the known drug targets for type 2 diabetes. Of course, we knew about them already, but it's interesting they pop up in this screen. And that tells me that there are probably some others in that list of 60 that we didn't know about that would also be very important as new drug targets. And this could be, in fact, one of the most significant developments in terms of identifying new therapeutic ideas instead of continuing down the same paths that we already have known about. This approach has played out in various interesting ways in various populations, and I just picked a few examples from these genome-wide association studies and maybe particularly ones that I thought might be of interest and relevance in Africa. Here's a publication from Charles's group, the first GWAS study in African ancestry populations, in this case on hypertension and blood pressure, and coming up with hits on a number of interesting genes, including a sodium-potassium-calcium exchanger, which makes a certain amount of sense, a voltage-dependent calcium channel, and others. And again, also on that list were genes that nobody would have predicted could possibly play a role in hypertension from what we knew about it then. But again, I hope you get the sense here of the power of this approach because it is comprehensive. You don't have to have the right hunch. The genome is a bounded set of information. And if you have a method that can scan the whole thing, you're going to come up with answers that don't require you to have the right guess when you start. And that kind of approach, where you can really expect to be able to get the entire set of answers instead of just looking under the lamppost to find your keys, which is what we've often done in the past, is truly exciting. Here's another one about infectious diseases, because clearly individuals have different susceptibilities when exposed to a pathogen. We know that's true for HIV. We certainly know that's true for malaria, the long-held understood story about sickle cell carriers being relatively immune, for instance, to cerebral malaria. But we also know this now for things like tuberculosis, because here is this paper from Nature Genetics last fall doing a GWAS study and identifying a susceptibility locus for TB on chromosome 18, and there are other such findings that have been reported in other parts of the genome. And again, if you can identify variants in the genome that confer either heightened or reduced risk for a disease like tuberculosis, that shines a light on the pathogenic pathway that the pathogen uses to cause disease, and that might turn out to be very useful therapeutically. One that I really like here in terms of therapeutic opportunities is about sickle cell disease. So sickle cell, after all, is a disease which in most patients causes severe difficulties beginning by about the first couple of years of life, with the sickling of the cells leading to obstruction of small vessels, to painful crises, to damage to organs, particularly to lungs, heart, kidneys. And yet, we have also observed over the course of time that some sickle cell patients have a milder course. And when you look to see why that is, a major reason is that some people actually have higher levels of fetal hemoglobin, and that seems to be protective. Now, fetal hemoglobin is that hemoglobin that you make primarily in utero, and then it gradually turns off, beginning a little bit before birth and completing within the first few months of life, and the adult hemoglobin, which is the one with the sickle mutation, comes on. But some of us don't turn that hemoglobin F quite all the way down, and if you happen to have sickle cell disease and a higher hemoglobin F, it's going to help you. So what is that about? What is it that allows fetal hemoglobin to stay on? This is a good question that you'd like to know the answer to, and this is very susceptible to this genome-wide association study. So what was done was to, in fact, show in a GWAS study that there's a very strong signal for a gene called BCL11A that plays a role in fetal hemoglobin. So BCL11A, there's two alleles here, as I hope you can maybe see in the lower right, but it's a little faint here. That actually has a very significant effect on what level of fetal hemoglobin you make as an adult. And it also turns out that has a very significant effect if you have sickle cell disease on what level of hemoglobin you make, hemoglobin F, and it also means it has a significant effect on whether you're going to have severe or mild disease. It turns out that BCL11A is a transcription factor, and it turns out that the version that leads to shutting down hemoglobin F is the one where you have higher levels of a particular isoform of this. So it normally suppresses hemoglobin F. So if you're thinking about making a drug, that's just the kind of thing you'd like to have, because it's always easier to suppress something than to activate it. So the idea here is make a small molecule, suppress BCL11A, increase hemoglobin F, and that might help sickle cell disease. Now, that is a hypothesis that hasn't yet been proven, but a lot of progress has been made in just a couple of years. And I think this is one of the most exciting developments in the potential for new treatments for sickle cell disease in a very long time. Here's one that I think also is particularly interesting from what it tells us about the interplay between selection on the human genome, which has been going on and continues to go on, and how that plays out in terms of other consequences. And this is the discovery of a variant in a gene called APOL1, which turns out to have two different effects. It turns out that the variant protects against sleeping sickness. And so you could imagine in parts of Africa where that is endemic, that having the protective allele would be good for you and would result in increased survival. But what we also have discovered is that this same variant may well account for the fact that Africans and African Americans have a significantly higher instance, 4- to 5-fold higher instance, of a kidney disease called focal glomerulosclerosis, which is relatively uncommon in those with European ancestry and much more common in those with a background from Africa. So it does seem that these are actually two sides of the same coin, that in an area where sleeping sickness was common, the protective allele was selected for, but actually that same allele can cause you trouble and result in this kidney disease. So it's a play, a back and forth between benefits and risks, and it is certainly an example where selection has left its mark on the genome. Perhaps the most famous of those, of course, is the sickle mutation that I talked about a minute ago, but here's another one, and there are many more. Pardis Sabeti has been looking across the genome for evidence of recent selection and found hundreds of examples where that seems to have happened in various parts of the world. Many of them, it seems, are going to be explained on the basis of infections, which have brought particular alleles to higher prevalence because of their protective ability. But not all of those will be benign in other circumstances, as this example shows. I'm not going to say a lot about cancer, but I suspect Sir Mark may very well touch on this, because I do think this is one of the main exciting payoffs right now of the ability to survey the genome, because after all, cancer is a disease of the genome. It comes about because of mistakes in DNA, either inherited or acquired during life. And again, because of the ability to use genomics in this sort of way, we can begin to ask and answer questions that previously puzzled us, but we weren't quite sure how to approach them. For instance, Funmi Olapati is trying to understand why do African-American women develop more aggressive breast tumors than women with European background. It's clear from epidemiology that's the case, but is that because of poor access to health care or some environmental influence or some genetic influence? Funmi is studying breast cancer genomics in West Africa to try to understand, are breast tumors in some way systematically different as a group in this situation? That doesn't prove to you whether it's genetic or environmental, but it would tell you something more about where to go and look next. And these kinds of approaches are now possible and would not have been a few years ago. And this just reminds me, because here we're talking about breast cancer, but we're also talking about implications across the world. Julio Frank, now the dean of the School of Public Health at Harvard, gave a lecture at NIH about a year ago that really stuck in my mind because of the case that he made for how important it is for research around the world to go forward, and how important it is to remind ourselves, as he did in this wonderful quote, that global is not the opposite of domestic. And I've been fond of quoting that back to some narrow-minded individuals in our country who wonder, why are you doing global health research? Well, because it's all about you, Congressman. Don't worry. We're all in the same boat here. It's just one world. I want to finish, though, by saying that I think we have some real challenges ahead, and I'm delighted to be here for the H3 Africa meeting beginning tomorrow, because one of those challenges is clearly that we need to focus research efforts where the opportunities are, and they don't all happen in the countries with high incomes, and we also need to therefore work on building capacity in countries around the world to do this research, because it is exciting. It is a great moment scientifically. And I'm fond of showing images from this website, which if you haven't discovered it, I would encourage you to go and have a look, called World Mapper. Because what they do with this website is to take the map of the world, which is here on the familiar basis based on landmass, and then they look at various parameters and say, okay, what would the world look like if you factored that in? So here's landmass. Now, what happens if you, for instance, pick a disease like HIV/AIDS and ask, where is it most predominant? Look and see what happens. So you can see the way in which Africa has occupying now almost most of the center of the picture. India also coming up very big. Lots of the rest of the world almost now shrunk back to little squiggles, except maybe for Haiti, which you see here. Dramatic ways to show evidence, which in tables is impressive, but somehow this seems to hit you harder. Non-communicable diseases, interestingly enough, while we think of those, at least I think many people do, as primarily diseases of high-income countries, and certainly there's plenty of that going on here in the U.S. and in Europe and in Japan. Look at China. Look at India. Africa here not coming up as fast yet, but if you had a trajectory, this would change over the course of time. Here's South Africa down here. Now, what about capacity for doing research? How would you look at that? Well, one way is to look at publications. So what does the world look like if you look at scientific publications? You see the problem here? We've got to fix this. Because look at this sort of bloated United States over here, and look at all of Europe, and Japan, my gosh, is like swallowing up half of the right side of the picture. This is South Korea, this big green blob. And, of course, where you look and hope to see much more opportunity in the future, here is Africa, and that's South Africa, that pink part down there. This is certainly something that could become an opportunity for great change. And I think those of us who are interested in global health are determined to make sure that that is one of the primary goals of everything we do. Capacity building is going to have to be done as true partnerships. It's going to need to involve investment in institutions as well as individuals. It's going to require replicating success stories. And it is going to require looking at what has worked and what has not. The Fogarty Institute, Fogarty International Center at NIH has been invested in this for a long time. And one very successful path is, of course, training. And here's a picture of Fogarty scholars and fellows at a recent gathering at NIH where they all came together to talk about their experiences along with their mentors. And the map here shows how these scholars and fellows have distributed across the world, and we're proud of that program and would like to continue or even expand it as one means of building capacity. I've spent the afternoon with the Centers of Excellence here on chronic diseases, supported by the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. And as you can see, these centers of excellence also intend to do a lot of this capacity building. Here's South Africa. You can see the other countries involved here. And I want to tell you about something which we will start kicking off on Monday in Johannesburg, which is the Medical Education Partnership Initiative, or MEPI, which has as its goal, very explicitly, the building of capacity both for training additional healthcare providers, but also to strengthen research. This was a highly competitive program co-funded by NIH and by the PEPFAR program, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, and working with Eric Goosby, who heads that up and who will be with me in Johannesburg on Monday when we initiate this program and bring together all the initial investigators, we will talk in great depth about how we might use this $130 million over 5 years to try to build capacity in these various partner countries and also to build a network amongst them. And I think you can see the potential here is really quite exciting. Finally, let me come back to H3 Africa, the reason that many of us have arrived in Cape Town and will be busily discussing details tomorrow and the next day. This is, again, along this same theme of attempting to build capacity, shifting from the practice of removing samples from Africa and analyzing them elsewhere to building the kind of infrastructure in terms of laboratory capabilities, in terms of biorepository, in terms of computational and IT efforts to allow the research to occur here on the continent. And the idea here is to build a network that could support population-based studies that would look at the combination of genetic and environmental risk factors for both communicable and non-communicable disorders, an ambitious effort to be sure. This began with some conversations in the African Society of Human Genetics, led then to an organizational discussion in Cameroon about 2 years ago, and then a white paper, which was the result of a meeting in Oxford last summer, and the white paper came out just 2 months ago and will be the starting point for the discussions that begin tomorrow. Again, support for this coming from NIH and the Wellcome Trust, and I think a very important partnerships that indicates the support of both of our organizations for the importance of doing this. And I'm very much looking forward to the discussions tomorrow to see how it is that we want to go forward. And obviously, this is a circumstance where more than ever, we need to understand from the perspective of African investigators what will make this work, because we're determined to have it be a successful effort. So I just finish with one more quote, and this is from my favorite South African, who happens to be a friend, Archbishop Desmond Tutu. You probably know he had his genome sequenced as a part of the effort to undergird our shared humanity And he quotes here in a piece that came out of Science Magazine just a couple of weeks ago, "My hope is that my genetic code may provide a voice for the region and serve as the starting point for a map of DNA variation significant for Southern African peoples to be used for medical research efforts and effective design of medicines. My dream," says the Archbishop, "is that by including all peoples in understanding and reading the genetic code, we will realize that all of us belong in one global family, that we are all brothers and sisters." Wow. And I echo his wow. What an amazing time this is. If you're new to science, perhaps it hasn't sunk in yet. What an amazing transition we have made in the last decade. From poking around areas that we understood poorly to having comprehensive abilities to ask questions. And there could never be a better time than to take that opportunity and spread it to investigators across the world. And so it is with great pleasure that I have a chance to be here with all of you here in Cape Town to take part in what I hope will be a very significant few days where we bring together the kind of talent and creativity that it's going to take to make the most of this opportunity, to understand what are the causes of illnesses that have puzzled us for all time, and to figure out what we might do to prevent and treat them. We should have no less ambitious goals than those. Thank you very much.